Welcome to New World Newts, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, Lance DeHaven Smith speaks with Wit and Wisdom on conspiracy theories, state crimes against democracy, and the get-out-of-jail-free card that every administration official seems to have in his wallet. I hope you'll stay tuned. Probably all of us have some unusual quirk. A quirk that makes you different from the majority of people. To others, if they even know you have it, your quirk may seem like a harmless eccentricity, easily forgiven or overlooked. To you, though, it's not just a preference, it's part of who you are. You feel comfortable when you're among others who share your quirk, and you feel a little edgy when you're surrounded by normal people. Do you know what I mean? I myself have a handful of quirks like this. One of them is, I guess, I'm an intellectual and a scholar at heart. Might as well come out of the closet and acknowledge it. Can't do anything about it. Might as well just accept it. One habit of mind of the scholar and intellectual is judiciousness. I admire that trait a lot. Judiciousness means being very sure that your conclusions are based on reliable evidence, and enough of it. Judiciousness also means getting very clear in your own mind about what you know for certain, and what you conclude is probably true, but you don't know for certain, and what is hypothesis or speculation. These are important distinctions. The propagandists who shape public opinion don't want you to think judiciously. They want you to believe what they tell you and then act accordingly without further thought. That's why America needs scholars and intellectuals. So I was excited to discover a new voice, a scholar I had never heard of, and an interesting one. He is Lance DeHaven Smith. That's hyphenated DeHaven Smith. He's professor of public administration and policy at Florida State University, and he is the author of the scholarly book Conspiracy Theory in America, published in 2013. DeHaven Smith says it is he who invented the term SCADS, which stands for State Crimes Against Democracy. SCADS. He argues that a SCAD is a more useful concept than the pejorative term conspiracy theory. In fact, the term conspiracy theory was introduced into mainstream usage by the CIA itself. This was a smear designed to discredit citizens who were looking closely into the JFK assassination. This week and next, we'll hear DeHaven Smith talk about the concept of SCADs, State Crimes Against Democracy. And he'll discuss some actual proven SCADs, such as candidate Richard Nixon's treasonous subversion of the Paris peace talks in 1968, and the Watergate affair, also the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And, here the speaker again is being judicious, he'll talk about events that look like they were probably SCADs, but we don't yet have enough evidence to be certain. These include the JFK assassination and at least some of the events of 9/11/2001. Speaking in Denver in September 2013, speaking of SCADs and conspiracy theories, here is Lance DeHaven Smith.
I thought there would be investigations after the 2000 election and that the crimes that were committed would be prosecuted or at least made known. And what happened instead was people were told, just move on, get over it. You know, there was an investigation, but it was set up so that it said the inquiry was about the technology, and it wasn't about the partisanship in the election administration. Have you seen this movie Recount? It goes over, well, they're actual crimes that are displayed in the movie, but you don't know they're crimes unless you know the law. On the morning after the election, after Election Day, the general counsel, the lawyer in Governor Jeb Bush's office, called the five largest law firms in Florida and told them that the governor didn't want them working for Al Gore. And they didn't work for him. He had to hire an attorney from out of state. They got boys. This is reported in the movie. It's just kind of a matter-of-fact thing. But the reality was that was a felony. That was use of public office for coercion. They were threatening these law firms with loss of business if they took on Gore's case. Well, there were many crimes like that committed during the 2000 election, and nothing was done. And even the movie Recount, you know, it shows James Baker. He comes across as this real tough guy who's, you know, really competent. And Warren Christopher, the leader of the Democratic of Gore's campaign, comes across as this wimp who gets, you know, pushed around by Baker. The reality was Warren Christopher was following the law. He was doing what the law said. He wanted to do the right thing, and Baker was abusing the law. So it was very frustrating seeing this. And I wrote a book about the 2000 election and specified the crimes that were committed. It was published by the University Press of Florida, an academic book. Got relatively little attention, but it laid the facts were there. But when I saw that nothing was going to happen about it, I started studying this topic. And I came up with this term, state crimes against democracy. I have a definition for it. Concerted actions or inactions by government insiders intended to manipulate democratic processes and undermine popular sovereignty. It's a terribly turgid definition. The way I developed it was I did a list of what these suspicious events are. There's some that we know there's no dispute about. The Watergate break-in, the crimes of Watergate, the Iran-Contra scandal, the outing of Valerie Plame, the lying us into war in Iraq. This is all documented. So we know that there are these high crimes to subvert democratic processes. But I did a list that included others that we suspect that. The Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, George Wallace, the attempt on his life, the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life, the 1968 October surprise. I'll tell you about what these are. But anyway, it was a long list. It was like 20-something events, about a third of which were well-confirmed and others we were suspicious about. And I extrapolated from that list to come up with this definition. The basic idea was to have a name for the type of crime that the term conspiracy theory discourages us from speaking about. If we can't name the crime, it's very hard to discuss it. I say actions or inactions. When there's a stand down like there was on 9/11 appears to be, where people don't defend the country, that's a SCAD. That's a crime in itself. It's a treason, a form of treason. The Vietnam War was started on a false pretense. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was passed. We had our gunships off the islands of North Vietnam, and we were firing on these islands, large cannon fire. And then when the North Vietnamese would come out, we would race back to international waters. Our ships reported they were attacked in the summer of 1964, and they said that they were doing nothing. They were in international waters minding their own business. And so the administration lied to Congress and got that war started when it was really a provocation or a kind of an inaction. I use government insiders because it isn't always the case that it's somebody in government. It can be a political insider. I'm thinking about Nixon. Nixon in 1968 was running for president. And there were peace talks going on between North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the United States. And Nixon thought if they made peace, that he would not win the election, that Hubert Humphrey, the Democratic candidate, would win the election. And so he sent word to North Vietnam, to their president, saying, withdraw from the peace talks, and I'll get you a better deal. That's a treason. I mean, what the man did was treason. The reason we know about this is because Lyndon Johnson, we have a taped telephone call between Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen, a U.S. senator, Republican leader at the time. And Lyndon Johnson knew that Nixon had done this because he had wiretapped Nixon's plane, his campaign plane. Yeah, I mean, these guys, I mean, they do all this stuff. I mean, Mission Impossible, you know, I mean, this is what these people do. This came out in 1997, and Johnson is talking to Dirksen, and he says, I can't believe he's done this. He sabotaged the peace talks. This is treason, but I'm not going to tell the American people because it would destroy their faith in their leaders and their country. So we learn about this in 1997. It's in the news one day. You know, and this is these events, they eventually become known, and we understand the dynamics of them and who was involved. But it's often long after the event. It receives very little attention, and there's no effort to go back and rewrite history with the awareness of this. But anyway, the point was Nixon was not in office, but he was a political insider, and he was doing this as an anti-democratic high crime. I've written a number of articles about this. I won't belabor this much, but I wanted you to know I first wrote about it and defined the state crimes against democracy concept or construct in 2006. And I started working with this guy, Matthew Witt. Matthew T. Witt is a professor at Laverne University in California. And I have to tell you, when you accept that John Kennedy was assassinated by the government, and the evidence is very strong for that, at the very least, the government covered up that it was a conspiracy. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And once you come to understand that, you should rethink how you think about American government. From then on, you should say, well, you know, these guys are capable of some pretty outlandish things. But my tendency was I would admit this about Kennedy. I would admit Watergate. Everybody knows Watergate. I think we tend to minimize it. Watergate is called the Watergate burglary. It was actually a wiretapping. And the people who were arrested were going back in to the National Democratic Party headquarters. They had wiretapped it 3 weeks prior, and they had transcripts, and they were reading them. But one of the wiretaps went out. So they were going back in to the National Democratic Party headquarters to replace that wiretap, and they got arrested. The two principals, Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, worked for the White House and were consultants for the Committee to Reelect the President. They had planned to kill Jack Anderson, an investigative reporter, and Teddy Kennedy, and they had monitored Teddy Kennedy's activities, but the plan was called off. There are many other things. I mean, when the guys were arrested, Howard Hunt sent his wife, Dorothy Hunt, to the White House to tell the White House, look, all of these people that have been arrested in Watergate have obligations. We have mortgages to pay. We have kids in college. We expect our expenses to be covered. They said, if you're in the CIA and you're arrested overseas, they take care of your family. And they felt like they were working for the president. They thought it was a legitimate operation, and they should be covered. Nixon referred to it as hush money. He understood it was blackmail. And John Dean speaks about Dorothy Hunt and says that she was just a completely savvy person, that she was, you know, wife of a CIA agent and had gone all over the world, and she had been a CIA agent in France before she married Howard Hunt. Well, Dorothy gets several hundred thousand dollars for the Watergate burglars, as they call it. They call the Watergate burglars because the day after it happened, the press secretary of President Nixon said, this is a third-rate burglary attempt. We had nothing to do with it. It's just a screw-up by these overzealous campaigners. And we call it a burglary to this day when it was espionage at the highest level, you know, attacking the opposition Democratic Party during a presidential election. What I wanted to tell you about Dorothy Hunt, though, was she was on a plane flight to Chicago with $10,000 in cash to disperse, and her plane crashed, and she was killed. There was a grand jury impaneled in Chicago, and they brought Robert Haldeman in to testify because they thought it had been that he had killed her, that the Nixon people had killed her. There was no evidence, and all they did was make him testify, and then they let him go. We know this in part because Haldeman tells this to Nixon in the White House, and we have it on the White House tapes. But the point is, Watergate was more than a burglary. I mean, we're talking about a crime spree of fairly wide proportions. The break-in to Howard Hunt's psychiatrist office, Ellsberg's psychiatrist office, there were 100 break-ins like that around Washington at that time, where the people's psychiatrists had their files rifled when they were providing service, psychoanalytic services to very important people's wives or husbands. So Watergate was, you know, this massive crime spree. Witt got me thinking about it in those terms. You know, I would say, well, you know, Nixon was crazy. I thought of Nixon as a, I mean, I think most of us do think about him as, you know, he was paranoid and nuts and a gangster. It took me a while to get used to the idea that a lot of them are like that. It's not just him, you know? So he helped me with that. We wrote an article in 2010 that was published in the American Behavioral Scientist, which is a fairly widely read journal. And there was an op-ed that was written by Mickey Huff, some guys at Project Censored. They said that they wrote about this study and they submitted it to an online website that they had published other things in, and they were told they would not publish this because it was on conspiracy theory. And they were stunned. I mean, they said, this is what we do. We publicize things that are being stifled, and we had this outlet, and they told us that we couldn't publish on that. But I don't think many people would have read it if these guys hadn't publicized it. I wrote an article on the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials, and this was kind of shocking to me to go back and read about this. I was teaching a class on international conflict and international law. So I read the Constitution, and I read the UN Charter, and I read the War Powers Resolution of 1973 and the 2001 authorization to use military force against the people who planned 9/11 and the 2002. And what I found was we break the law all the time. Okay? I mean, when we threaten Syria, that's a violation of the UN Charter. We are signatories to the UN Charter. Our Constitution says our treaties are the highest law of the land. They're higher than the law. They're higher than the Constitution. And that treaty says we're not going to invade people unless we're being attacked. And we have to get a resolution from the United Nations to continue, even if we're attacked. We have to get their support to continue it. But we violate it all the time. Well, I went back. I said, you know, let's look at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials. And to my surprise, what I found was that the first charge in the indictment of the Nazi war criminals was a conspiracy charge. They had conspired to overthrow the parliamentary government in Germany and then warmonger and strike fear into people's hearts and then start an aggressive war against other countries. Do you know what we did to these people? We hung them. They included not only politicians, they included diplomats who were fronting for the Nazi war of aggression. They included journalists who were warmongers and anti-Semites. They included lawyers. We prosecuted these criminal cases because after the war, Stalin said, let's kill all the officers in the Nazi army. And Churchill said, no, we can't do that. Let's kill 20,000 of them. And it was kind of glib, but that's really what they said. And the Americans said, no, we have to teach a lesson to the German people. We have to show them what their leaders did, and we have to show them that they have a responsibility as citizens in an elected representative democracy to not let power be consolidated and to never let this happen again. The Germans have learned that lesson pretty well. I mean, they're very cautious about what they do in foreign policy. And what I did in this article was simply compare what the Bush-Cheney administration did in terms of twisting the intelligence and telling people that we were going to be potentially, that this country was trying to build nuclear bombs and had weapons of mass destruction and they could give them to terrorists and we were in peril, when they knew otherwise. They knew otherwise. They, you know, the torture that we talk about? The torture occurred in August of 2002 at Guantanamo Bay. There were two people tortured. And they were waterboarded like 186 times. I mean, it was a horrendous thing. But what they were doing was trying to get confessions linking 9/11 to the country of Iraq. And once they couldn't get that, they stopped it. There was Abu Ghraib and all that. That was different. This was torture that was came right out of the White House. So anyway, I did this article and said, if you look at what the Bush-Cheney administration did and you compare it to our charges against the Nazis at Nuremberg, you'll find they're parallel, almost exactly, bang, bang, bang. I could not get that published in the United States. I had it reviewed at one journal three times, and the reviewers kept saying, this is a great article. This is an important article. We cannot publish it. Literally, I'd never seen anything like this. I submitted it to Contemporary Politics was the name of the journal, and they published it right away. It's published in London. It's a British journal. It taught me a lesson about what we're up against. Science is supposed to be a search for the truth. It's not an organ of legitimation for the power structure in America, but that's pretty much what it appears to be because it was too controversial. But the reason I tell you about it is you're probably not aware of the academic background on it. And there's a pretty good body of research now that establishes that there are these kinds of crimes. They need to be looked at comparatively and collectively together so you see patterns in them. And that you can't depend on the government to... There are a number of reasons I'll go over why we can't depend on the government to give us the truth. There's a book from Paul Gray MacMillan on state crimes against democracy. That's the title of the book. So the term's getting out. That just came out about 3 months ago. I won't belabor this, but I just want to point out that SCAD is not a conspiracy theory. It's not a term for that. It's a term for the crime. We wouldn't say white-collar conspiracy, you know, or white-collar theory. We would say white-collar crime. And it's the same way with state crimes. You have to think in terms of crimes, not theories of crimes. I think you all know that it's a pejorative term. The problems with the term conspiracy theory, it's a totally nonsensical term. The way it's used is anything that is suspicious of government insiders conspiring to subvert democratic processes is considered ludicrous, paranoid. Well, it's nonsensical because we know conspiracies happen. We had Watergate, we had Iran-Contra, we had Plangate. We know conspiracies happen. So it's crazy to say any suspicion of conspiracy has got to be ludicrous. It's quite the opposite. You should be carefully discerning what are reasonable suspicions and what are not. The conspiracy theory label lumps everything together, from aliens taking over the planet to who assassinated Kennedy. And you lump them all together and then take the most ludicrous example and equate all other suspicions with that. That's not reasonable. That's unreasonable. Conspiracy theory label is un-American. The Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory. I urge you to read it. The first part of the Declaration is about inalienable rights, but then it goes on to list a set of crimes that King George committed or was suspected of committing that were intended together to deprive the colonists of their rights as British citizens. And they said they suspected that King was trying to gain tyranny over them and that gave them the right. Not any of the crimes individually, but what they suspected about his motives. So people who say conspiracy theory is ludicrous forget that America was founded on a conspiracy theory. When people use the term conspiracy theory, what they're forcing on you, in addition to shutting you up and saying that you're crazy, what they're suggesting is that the official account of these events is solid, strong evidence, and what you've got is speculation and, you know, at the very least, dubious. But in reality, if you look at the official accounts of things like the Kennedy assassination or 9/11, basically they are coincidence theories. They're troubling patterns that on their face look suspicious, and they're dismissed as coincidences. When you talk about 9/11 to somebody, or the anthrax letter attacks, or the Kennedy assassination, they will tell you that the American government would not commit crimes like this. And furthermore, if they did commit them, they're not competent enough to do it. They couldn't pull it off. And furthermore, if they, by some fluke, they did succeed in doing one of these things, they couldn't keep it quiet. Somebody would talk. So there's this assumption that you couldn't do these things. They're just on its face. I have Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, the cover up there. It's a great book. What he reminds us of is that the Manhattan Project, which involved 100,000 people developing the atomic bomb, was kept secret throughout World War II. Totally secret. Truman, when he became president after FDR died, he did not know about the atomic bomb for a week until they told him. It's kept secret through compartmentalization, the need to know. People are working on it, but they don't know what it is. They're doing this part, they're doing that part, building the casing, you know. So it's quite easy for the government to keep secrets. It does an excellent job of it. It's got a very sophisticated technique for doing it. Ellsberg also points out that people who are privy to these secrets think they are really special, think that they really know what's up. So they don't want to tell anybody. What they do is remain silent. He says they listen to people and they think in their minds, if this person knew what I knew, they wouldn't be saying what they're saying. They consider everybody else really just foolish and out of the loop. And the last problem with the conspiracy theory label is that people who use it attack individuals. They attack individuals who say that John Kennedy was killed by more than one shooter, or 9/11 was a controlled demolition of the buildings. They attack individuals, but they never talk about the conspiracy theories of the institutions, of the government itself. The conspiracy theory of Iraq trying to get nuclear weapons. Now, that was a dangerous conspiracy theory. That was a conspiracy theory that cost 100,000 lives and thousands of our soldiers. That was a dangerous conspiracy. Does anybody say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, you shouldn't say that? No, no. So it's really a terrible term.
Lance DeHaven Smith, speaking on what's wrong with the term conspiracy theory, and, more importantly, what's wrong with the government itself committing major crimes to further its own ends. That was part one. More of this interesting talk next week. Our thanks to Robin Upton of Unwelcome Guests for supplying and editing the original recording. I have edited it some more myself. UnwelcomeGuests.net. That's them. And NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. That's us. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimae non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao.